Okay, Yara. Let's see who blasts this bogey first. He lines up his shot. Something hits his ship hard. And next thing he knows, he's spinning like a corkscrew. His brain forces itself to catch up to his head as he spirals out of control. And past ropes of cackling electricity, he sees on his screens that the wings have been sheared off on the one side. They're gone! I'm going down. I'm hit. Mom! He pulls up on the stick and levels out just as the X-Wing belly flops into the dust, kissing the surface of Jakku and sending up a tidal spray of sand behind him. The ship slides along on its belly, grinding and hissing as it does. Temin's head snaps hard left and right, cracking into the blast glass of the cockpit viewports, each time rocking his dome dizzy. The cockpit pops, and he paws at the edges of his seat, pulling himself out. Temin rolls over the edge of the X-Wing, landing in the space where the wings should be. His shoulder hits stone. He turns over and dry heaves. When he finally looks up again, he sees what took him out. Two dunes away, pitting a pair of S-foils, is a fist of metal from what looks like a Starhawk.
A Starhawk? I thought the Ravager was hit.
And it all starts coming down. Meteors made of broken starships start plowing into the ground. Each time they hit, Jakku coughs up another geyser of sand. Temin cries out at the cacophony of sound. The booming drum of the planet being struck. The susurrus of sand rising and falling back to itself. The distant explosions. His ears ring, and he clamps his hands over them. Temin risks looking up to see if he can spot the rest of Phantom Squadron. But as he does, the light is blotted out. Day turns to night in the matter of moments. It's the Ravager. The Imperial Colossus drifts in front of the light, eclipsing the sun. Another ship precedes it. That's the Starhawk. Fire comes off the New Republic ship, tornadoes of flame crackling from holes in its side. He thinks, it's coming down right on top of me. There's nowhere to run, nowhere I can go to get safe. But the panic subsides when he realizes his perspective is off. Yes, the ship is massive, but no, it's not coming down here. It'll hit dozens of clicks away. But what will it hit? Who will it destroy? Their own people are that way. So is the enemy. That's the Imperial line. The fighting is going on right there. Temin pulls up his wrist comm and starts babbling into it, telling everyone to go, to move, to get out of the way. But the device suddenly fritzes out and spits sparks before going dead. A sound comes out of him, a small, fearful moan. He's never seen anything like it before. He wonders if this is how his mother felt flying inside the Death Star, and then escaping, watching it detonate behind her. The Ravager struggles to stay aloft. He can see, even in the half-dark of eclipsed day, how, underneath, its positioning thrusters fire intermittently, desperately working to keep it from pointing straight at the ground, but failing to stop its fall. It moves inescapably toward the ground, leaning hard to the side. The Starhawk hits first. Temin runs up to the nearest dune and watches as the New Republic capital ship crashes into the sand, crumpling up as if some giant just stepped on it. He sees an AT-AT walker moving away from the impact site as fast as it can, which from here looks dreadfully, painfully slow. And it won't matter anyway. With the Starhawk gone, the tractor beam shears, and the Ravager's thrusters must cause it to overcompensate. It begins to invert, turning belly up as it drops. The Ravager hits next. It hits broadly, not spearing the ground, but crashing flat against it, upside down. The AT-AT never has a chance. Nor do the starfighters trapped in the shadow of the dreadnought before it crashes. Nobody does. It's like watching the ceiling fall down on a child's playroom of toys. The Ravager plows into the sand, and the impact rocks the whole world. The vibration moves outward in a monstrous ripple, sending sand up along the shockwave, and when it hits where Temin is standing, it knocks him off his feet. Again, his ears ring. Everything vibrates. His teeth, his toes, all his bones. He struggles to stand anew. And already, he can't see the Ravager anymore. A dust cloud of titanic proportions has been thrown into the sky. An anvil of black smoke goes up. Rolling outward is a cloud of dark dust. It's coming this way. The blood-red dust cloud bulges and roils, tumbling forward like a wave of death and despair. Temin scrambles back to his downed X-wing, sliding into the cockpit and slamming it shut just as the dust and the sand wash over him. It brings the white sound of 1,000 angry whispers all around him, against the glass, against his ship. And it goes on for what seems like forever.
Move over, Nora barks. Let me fly it.
I know how to fly, Sloane snarls from the pilot's seat, her fingers gone bloodless from holding the shuttle's flight stick. She weaves the ship in and out of a rain of falling debris as each piece plunges to the ground like a comet. I'm a damn good pilot. I got away from you, remember?
Nora remembers. She grits her teeth and holds onto a handle above her head as Sloane whips the craft through the raining debris. Brenton sits in the co-pilot's seat, his face gone white, his eyes closed. He never was much of a flyer. Part of her wants to comfort him. Another part wants to take the blaster and knock some sense into his head with the butt of it. Bone stands behind her, stabilized without holding on to anything. She's about to say something else. The day goes to night. Sloane's gaze drifts upward. She gasps. A ragged, despairing sound.
No, my ship.
Those three words transmit such grief. Nora can't help but feel drawn in by them. It's absurd, maybe, to be so enamored with and connected to a ship. But Nora understands it. She didn't have a long career in that Y-Wing, but in the short time that she did, she came to love it like Temin loves that droid. Nora's eyes drift away from the Ravager to what precedes it. It's one of the Starhawks. She can't tell which one, but fear eats at her like an acid.
It's the Concorde, isn't it?
Nora doesn't know Kirsta Augate very well, but the woman was kind to her when she didn't need to be. Her reputation was that she was hard, but had empathy. Not just for her own people, but for the enemy too. Nora hopes she'll see Augate again. The Starhawk hits the surface of Jakku, and moments later, the Ravager follows. It drops hard. A concussive wave kicks up, rocks the ship. Nora has a distant, disconnected thought that she cannot dwell on for long, lest it destroy her.
How many died? How many died on that ship? Or underneath it as it fell?
That, coupled with the feeling of victory in her heart. The one that tells her the New Republic may just have finished this war. It is a crass dichotomy, that feeling. She's felt it before, and she'll feel it again. The triumphant heart warring with the grief born of war. Nora composes herself. Her fight isn't over. None of this is. Sloane seems to pull herself together, too. The ex-admiral sets her jaw and her flight course, pulling away from the direction of the Ravager.
Dust cloud coming in, she warns.
It's out there. A fast-moving storm spilling toward them. The cloud lights up in places with bilious lightning. Thunder tumbles. Sloane pulls the shuttle away from it, but still, it encompasses them. When it does, the shuttle rocks back and forth, hitting tides of air turbulence that nearly have Nora losing her footing. Through the dust storm, she sees black clouds rising up above as pillars of fire and lightning brighten the air. And then it's gone again, washing over them and thinning out. The air is still gauzy with particulate matter, but once more, the horizon can be seen. Bones suddenly stiffens. His antenna glows green, beeping.
Master Timon is near.
What? Where?
Hello! May I go?
Nora knows that him leaving makes her vulnerable. If her husband is still in thrall to the control chip and sides with Sloane against her, she's not sure she can survive. But if Timon really is near, and maybe in danger, then the choice is no choice at all. Go! Bones flees, his claw feet clanking as he opens the ramp in the belly of the shuttle. She watches him collapse downward, tucking his narrow beaked head to his chest and wrapping his many jointed arms around his knees before rolling out of the ship and down to Jakku. When the storm is past, Timon once again reopens the cockpit and emerges. Though the wave has dissipated, dust still hangs gauzy in the air, and he coughs and blinks it away as he drops to the ground and staggers through the sand. What passes next are a few moments of almost eerie silence. The world gone still in the aftermath of the impact. Then, somewhere far away, an explosion goes off. From the Ravager's wreckage, no less. Above the dreadnought, black specters of smoke rise, and those dark clouds pulse with a flickering fire glow. A stink of burning metal and spent fuel stings his nose. After that, the sounds of war return. Blaster shrieks and fighter engines roaring overhead. Concussive pulses and grenade detonations. Soldiers screaming. The silence is over. Again, he coughs, wincing. In the distance, he spies a contingent of New Republic commandos dug in behind the sand furrow kicked up by a wrecked transport. Troopers advance on them. Timon thinks, I should do something. I should help. From close by come the pneumatic piston sound and pounding footsteps of something all too familiar. An AT-ST walker. He sees its brutal cockpit crest the nearest dune. The cannons tracking in his direction. Timon knows he can't take that thing down, so he draws his blaster and runs in the other direction, feet carrying him over one dune and down the other, even as the thing's cannons surely track his movement. And then, he's running full throttle into a trio of desert troopers. Their armor scarred, the grooves and joints caked with dust. They raise their blasters, and he skids to a halt, holding his in the air. The troopers don't say anything at first. Already that makes his hackles rise. Imperial soldiers are about protocol. They have a pattern. They warn you, tell you to drop it, like they're on a program. But this time, they follow no protocol. They remain silent. Behind him, the AT-ST tromps up the dune toward them. Its shadow falls across Timon. A shadow so damning, it's as if it has its own weight. Timon swallows hard, feeling sweat run down his jaw, his neck, his collarbone. I...
Shut your mouth,
the middle trooper says. That one's helmet has a hard dent in the plastoid surface. He's got a pauldron over the right shoulder, red and dark as a hot coal. He's the leader.
Rebel scum! Let's have some fun with this one,
says the trooper on the right, the face of the helmet painted with finger streaks of gray ash. The one on the left takes off his helmet. A jowly, scruff-cheeked man's face is underneath, lit up with rage. He points the blaster.
We shoot bits off him, one by one. Hands, ears, each knee. See how long we keep him alive. Then the AT-ST can finish him off. Scatter his atoms.
The one in the pauldrons says,
"We should do it quickly. Get back to the battle."
"Battle's over," Ashstreak says. "Might as well have fun."
"Nobody's listening to the leader. Nobody's listening to anybody. I'm going to die."
Scruffcheek looks up.
"Hey, what the..."
Temin whirls around to see something land, crab-like, on top of the AT-ST's cockpit skull. That something lifts its head, feral and red, showing off a set of hand-cut saw teeth.
"Bones!"
The troopers open fire, but Bones is fast, too fast for them. The droid grabs the rail at the edge of the AT-ST, swinging down like a monkey lizard before flinging himself to the sand, landing in a crouch. Blaster fire riddles the space where he just was as he pivots, pirouettes, and begins handspringing across the sand, plasma cooking the air as he dances around each lance of searing light. Arms snap back, blades stick out. Bones goes to work. He gets under the pauldroned leader, sticking a vibroblade up underneath the chin of the helmet with a dull crunch. The man's body twitches as his blaster drops. The modified B-1 droid whirls around the still-standing corpse like it's a pole, kicking out with one clawed foot and knocking Ashstreak back. As that trooper falls to the ground, Bones pounces on his chest and perforates the armor again and again with the blades. The man's heels kick the ground. Scruffcheek bellows for the AT-ST to fire. And fire it does. Loud blasts from its cannons biff through the sand, just missing Bones, but knocking the droid back, limbs akimbo. The scruffy trooper raises his own rifle to fire on Bones, and Temin launches himself at the man. His attack is clumsy and broadcast a kilometer away, but the helmetless stormtrooper isn't paying attention. Temin clubs the soldier in the temple with his own blaster, and the man topples like a tree. Bones is up again, cartwheeling away from the AT-ST's cannons. It tracks him, but its head is too slow, and the droid too fast. Temin's mechanical bodyguard returns to the place it landed, scurrying up the side of the walker's leg, metal clicking on metal, until it reaches the top once more. The droid struggles, his servos grinding, and his pneumos whining as he wrenches the top off the AT-ST, flinging the hatch behind him. Feet first, Bones silently slips into the cockpit of the chicken walker. Thus commences a bang and a rattle. The walker rocks back and forth, just slightly. It takes 10 seconds, no more, before Bones pops back out, wearing one of the driver's open-face helmets. A pair of black lens goggles hanging off in front of the B-1's own ocular lenses.
"Hello, Master Temin."
Temin falls to his knees, relieved.
"Bones, I missed you, buddy."
"I missed you. I performed thy off."
Suddenly, the top of the walker erupts in fire and shrapnel, exploding. Temin is knocked backward, the breath knocked from his lungs in a thunderclap of air. He waves smoke out of his face and wipes the sand from his eyes, and when it clears, he sees the walker standing there. It's just two legs now. The cockpit is peeled back like a blooming metal flower, its durasteel petals burned and charred. Bones is nowhere to be found.
"Bones? No! Bones! No!"
He cries out, wondering what happened. Did it detonate all on its own? Was there something the droid did to cause it to explode? But then, a pair of A-wings appear overhead, roaring past. It was them. They shot the walker, and Bones along with it. Temin crawls on his hands and knees, looking for parts of his droid. He finds seared, melted limbs. He finds rivets and scrap. But he sees nothing else. No skull, no program motherboard.
He draws sand into his hands, but it slips through his fingers with nothing to show for it. Bones saved his life, and now is gone. His best friend is Slag. Temin presses his forehead to the hot sand and weeps.
Chapter 34.
You don't have to do this,
Condor says. Sinjir huffs a lamentable sigh.
Apparently I do. Job's a job, and, oh gods, I just started a new job. What is wrong with me?
The two of them stand before Senator Tolwar Wartol's Ganoidian cruiser. Thankfully, it's here on Chandrilla again, and didn't require them to take a quick hop to blah-blah-boring farm world, Nakadia, or worse, to the asteroid archipelago above Orish that Wartol and his like call home. Sinjir cares little why he's back on Chandrilla. The convenience of it suits him, and he is nothing if not a man who appreciates ease. Condor makes that face, a little pouty, a lot dubious. One eyebrow up, a twist to his lips, a cockiness to his hips.
I don't mean this specifically. I mean the whole package. The job, Chandrilla, me.
You? I don't follow.
You don't have to be with me. Fate put us together again, and it's just, we don't have to do this.
Oh, but we do.
Sinjir cups the man's beardy cheek first with a gentle caress, and then with a sharp tap-tap slap.
Dearest fool heart, all my time away was spent thinking about how much I hated you. And I hated you because I liked you so much. Too much, really.
It's gross the way I feel about you.
It's like...
Sinjir makes a face as if he just sucked on a dirty thumb.
Ah! It's really not natural to me. But I learned that I don't know what the precious hell I'm talking about. My mind is an idiot. My heart knows all. I want what I want. What I want is a beach view. A cold glass of something very drunk-making. And you. You noble, fuzzy-faced fool.
So if that means becoming just a hair respectable and entering into the service of our most estimable Chancellor, then that is what will be done.
You aren't the settling-down type.
Sinjir rolls his eyes so hard, he fears they might tumble out of his head.
Ha! Ah, who says I'm settling? Settling is such a passive affair. Settling is how a hut slug sits down. I've been settling since Endor. Settling for whatever comes my way. Usually a bar stool, if we're being honest. You, this job, this life, it's all a mountain. And I intend quite fully to climb it.
Condor smirks. Sinjir destroys that smirk with a hard kiss. Hands behind the head, drawing the man's face to his.
Well then,
Condor says.
Well then.
Sinjir turns back toward the cruiser.
I suppose I should do this.
At his feet sits the basket of pita fruit. Looking at it again reminds him how much he admires the Chancellor. Not for all her leadership and governance, which is fine, whatever, but for the potent venom she quite plainly conceals inside that boring white-robed facade. She's a vicious twig, a veritable whipping branch of a human being. And he thinks they could have a long and fascinating professional relationship.
I still think Tolwar is dirty.
I cannot speak to his cleanliness.
No, I mean I think he's corrupt.
Sinjir shrugs.
Of course he's corrupt. He's a politician.
The bug. The one in Leia's droid. He planted it. I couldn't manage to track it back to him, but he was the one who gained from the information. It had to be him, Sinjir. I know it.
One suspects that's true. He was using it to gain a political advantage, not a criminal one.
The Orshin are almost overly noble, driven mad by an aggressive sense of honor. Something-something sacrifice, something-something stern father telling his son how hard it is out there. He sneers. I do despise how they name themselves, though. Tulwar Wartol, Vendar Darven, Tim Tam Tam Tim. You'd think they could be more original.
It's cultural.
Well, that's no excuse.
Go,
Condor says.
Deliver your fruit. Be as polite as you can manage. Do not start an intergalactic incident.
Those I leave to Jom.
Have fun at work, honey.
Thank you, doll. And if you call me honey again, I'll rip that beard off your face swatch by swatch with miserable pinching tugs. He mimes the gesture with his hand, just in case Condor doesn't get it.
You're such a romantic.
My heart is a dry nest of dead birds. He stoops down to kiss the man's scrubby cheek. Bye, Con.
Bye, Sin.
Wartol sits, still as the steeple of an old temple. In front of him is a cup of something bitter-smelling, probably some kind of old root juice the Orishan people consume. Steam rises off it. Around, the Ganoidian cruiser is decked out in the Orishan way. Severe, spare, blocky, unpleasant. Sinjir likes it. It's quiet, too. No security to be found. No pilot. No anyone except for the senator himself. He sets the basket on the floor. A gift from the Chancellor.
You're the ex-imperial.
Wartol's voice is a deep, thrumming timbre. And you're the Chancellor candidate, who's been outplayed at every turn, including by a ginger woman with a single sour fruit. Oops. The senator's slitted nostrils pucker with irritation, even as his jaw gently eases apart before stitching back together again.
You work for her now? You're a symptom. You see that, don't you? A symptom of a larger, nastier disease.
Do tell.
An imperial working for the Chancellor? So cozy with her. Oh, my, how cosmopolitan. Your presence has infected the process. Whispering in her ear, surely. Ah, but I give you too much credit. You won't lead her. She'll lead you. She'll lead us all. Mon doesn't need you to thin her moral code, because it's already thinner than a slurry made of spit. Mon Mothma is weak. She will destroy this republic if we let her. People like you at her side will only hasten its demise. We'll blink, and one day the republic will have fallen, and the Empire will step out of her shadow and gently take its place.
Sinjir thinks at first to hold his tongue. But really, what's the point? The Chancellor knew what she was getting when she sent him along. You ask a hound to find a bone, you can expect some holes dug in the yard. And it's not like the pitta fruits are a subtle message, are they? No. She wants him to scrap a little. Sinjir will do it, so she doesn't have to. He says, it's ironic, you know. You go on about fearing another empire, and yet you're the one who reminds me of every imperial autocrat. Every bully-fed officer who thinks that the best way to lead is through acts of severity, through a parade of cruelty, just to remind the men, life is hard, and so you must be harder. They go on about sacrifice, but never really sacrifice squat themselves. Oh, no, because they're the ones above the heavy boot on the back of the neck, not the ones beneath it. You want war. You want defense. You're a raptor who sees all his people as defenseless little flit-wrens. And you'll save them, if only they give up the fanciful notion that they can lead themselves.
that they can protect themselves.
You understand nothing.
Meanwhile, Sinjir says, really leaning into it now, your opponent is a woman who wants to give democracy to the entirety of the galaxy. Freedom for all, oppression for none.
It's naive.
It may be, but at this point I'm going to side with her precious naivete over your authoritarian bluster. Enjoy your fruit, Senator. We'll send you a lifetime supply as a consolation when you lose the election. Sinjir sets the basket down on the table. And when he does, he notices three things. First, Wartol never stood up. That's odd. It's standard to get up and greet guests no matter how much you despise them, especially among the Orishin, who have a rather firm grip on protocol. Second, Wartol's left hand holds the cup of steaming dark juice, but his right hand has never gone above the table. It rests beneath it. Third, on the surface of the table, across from where the Orishin sits, waits a faint ring of moisture, as if from a cup resting there, a cup sweating its condensation or steam onto the tabletop. Sinjir's gaze turns to it, then to Wartol. The senator is watching him. Wartol saw him look. It is necessary, perhaps, to acknowledge it. Had a guess, did we? Sinjir says.
Not your business, Imperial.
No, it's not. You're right. He's acting cagey, the senator. Sinjir knows body language, and a lot of that transcends species, sex, age. It's not just that Wartol is hiding something. It's that what he's hiding is up under his skin plates. It's nesting there, like worm hatchlings. He's bothered by it. He doesn't want it discovered, so Sinjir decides he's going to pick this scab, see what bleeds. Still, though, why don't you tell me anyway? We're friends, aren't we? I won't tell anyone. Wartol says nothing. He barely even twitches. Sinjir remains where he is, half leaning over the basket of fruit. The silence is a wall between them. Then the wall shatters. Wartol kicks back, his hand up and out. A blaster is in his claw-like fingers. Sinjir stares down the mouth of that pistol. A fat-barreled, snub-chambered Kanji-made blaster. Like the kind criminals use. And the weapon goes off. But Sinjir turns to the side, flattening his profile as the blast pocks the far wall of the cruiser's sitting room. He has no blaster of his own in kind. Curse you, Sinjir. You should always bring a weapon when tangling with a politician. So he grabs what's close at hand, the basket. He gets his long fingers under the basket's seat and flips it hard toward the Orishin. Wartol bats it away. Fruit goes everywhere. Through a spray of pitta juice, Sinjir rushes the man. The air lights up again, and something catches Sinjir hard, and his head snaps back, and he smells singed blood and burning hair. Everything goes sideways as the world wheels out from under him. His eyes cross. I've been shot. An absurd thought, because he's fairly certain he has been shot in the head, which is not a good way to live, and is in fact a very good way to die. Wartol lurches over him, a blurry shape as Sinjir's vision struggles to find clarity. The blaster is up again. Sinjir's spidery fingers scrabble over the ground, finding something there, something wet, slimy, seedy.
It's too late, Wartol says,
cryptic. What's too late? The blaster goes off. Sinjir rolls aside as a flash of hot energy digs a furrow into the floor right by his head. His ear goes shrill as it rings, and the side of his cheek feels hot, and the other side of his head feels slick. He whips his hand up, flinging whatever was in it. A pitta fruit spatters uselessly against Wartol's face. It hits. It drips. It plops back down to the ground. His jaw extends outward and curls into an underbite, and the senator blasts a puff of air upward.
unmooring dribbling pitta juice from his nose slits and brow.
The fruit won't save you now,
Sinjir says. No, but it distracted you, didn't it? Wartol makes a bewildered animal sound. Just as a blaster goes off and clips him in the shoulder. He spins like a child's top and crashes against his own chair. His cup of whatever it was splashes down against him and shatters. The snub-barreled blaster drops. Condor steps forward, his own blaster in hand, and steps down on it. With a quick slide of his foot, he sends the blaster spinning to Sinjir, who snatches it and wearily stands.
Am I being shot in the head?
He asks Condor. Condor's eyes open in shock, and his mouth forms an alarmed O shape.
Well, I suppose that answers that.
Sinjir's hand flies to the side of his head. It comes away wet with his own blood. Some of it has already been cauterized, making it tacky against his fingers. The shot glanced along the side of his head, carving a furrow that starts at his temple.
Sin, I think you'll be all right.
I'll be fine. My rather luxurious hair? Not so much.
He strides forward and stands atop Wartol.
You! Answer for yourself!
Die, Imperial slime!
Sinjir points the blaster and shoots the man in the knee. He howls!
Now, I'm of a mind not to actually kill you because I'm one of the good ones these days, and I have appearances to keep up. But I will whittle you down until you're not but a talking, jabbering head. Why pull a blaster? What are you hiding?
Ah! I told you! It's too late!
What is too late?
I can't call him off now!
Sinjir shoots the other knee. Wartol bellows, sitting suddenly upright like a book slammed shut. He clutches at his knee as purple blood bubbles between his fingers.
Ah!
Call who off? What are you...
At first he thinks it's thunder, the faraway sound. But thunder is a low rumble, like a sallow belly expressing its hunger. This is duller, deeper, one and done. A hard, shuddering boom. An explosion.
What did you do, Wartol? What did you do?
Wartol's laugh dissolves into a blubbering confession.
Sacrifices are necessary, Imperial. Sometimes a disease is so rampant, you must cut off limbs to save the body. Like an Orish. The Empire was a cancer on the galaxy. Just as Mon Mothma was a cancer on the Republic.
Was a cancer? Was?
You didn't,
Sinjir seethes. But Wartol simply weeps. Not from grief, no. But what Sinjir sees is clearly relief. Condor steps back and unrolls his sleeve. Underneath is nothing so small as a comlink, but rather a whole tech gauntlet. With it, he can slice into doorways or program droids or any number of things. But he can also tap into various feeds. Holonet, Orbit Control, NRN News, and of course, local security bureau transmissions. He dials into the frequency. The air fills with static, then resolves into a voice.
Code 424, repeat, code 424. Reports of an explosion at the North Tower of the Senate building. Code 424.
Sinjir thinks,
No, it's not possible.
He marches straight to the door, to the ramp, down to the landing bay. All of the landing bays here are up high, over the coast. And at this vantage point, it's easy to see the center of Hana City, where the Senate building sits. Looming above that building is the tower where Mon Mothma's office sits, where Sinjir was only hours before. A hole has been blown in the side of it. Even from here, he can see how ash and debris are vacated out into open air. How the white permacrete side is charred with soot and tongues of flame.
Smoke billows out like an escaping friend. The Chancellor. She was in there. He left her alone in there.
Sidgir turns, marches back inside, pistol up. He storms through to the sitting area, past Condor, then drops to Wartol's chest. He screws the barrel of the Kanji blaster so hard against the man's forehead, it nearly breaks the hard plating that covers the man's head.
You killed her!
I had it done, Wartol croaks.
You will pay for this.
Do it! End me. I have no career, but I have sacrificed myself to make a better galaxy. Chancellor Mon Mothma will no longer be able to spread her corrosive stain across the burgeoning New Republic.
Wartol lifts his head into the blaster.
Pull the trigger, coward!
Sinjir roars and draws the blaster back. His chest heaves as rage runs so hot inside him. It's like a star burning itself up. But he resists.
You'll not die today. You'll go to trial. You'll go to prison. You'll see your name and your people dragged out in front of us all as craven traitors.
He looks to Condor. The man gives him a small nod. It's a small concession. A mote of light in a suddenly dark day. But it's all he has. So he holds on to it as tightly as he can manage.
Interlude. Liberty's Misrule.
The Dreadnought is no longer the Annihilator. It is no longer called that, because that is no longer its function. Now it serves as the capital ship in a new galactic nation forming at the fringes of the galaxy, in wild space and beyond. The ship's new name? Liberty's Misrule. That name means whatever it means to whoever hears it. But Eliodi Marakavanya, pirate captain of this ship, and leader of this new, unnamed nation of deviants and miscreants, chose the name first because, quite frankly, she likes the damn sound of it. But also because it means the ship is no longer used to destroy. Now it is used to create. A new government. A new nation. An armada of pirates who take equal spoils in an effort to make something lasting. Most pirates, they take what they take to live and fight another day. They take the spoils to survive or to squirrel away. But Eliodi wants something bigger, better, something forever. The Empire is dead, and the New Republic can't handle its business. That leaves room. Air whistling between the bricks, where Eliodi can slip in and out, like a breath, hiding in the interstitial spaces, growing like an army of ghosts.
Right now, she stands at one of the many thousands of viewports here on the Liberty's Misrule, looking out over Xur ragtag nation of ships, a nation without a planet, but one that may never need one.
The stars are our nation, she thinks. We glitter like a thousand suns. Our hearts as black as the void in which we travel.
Next to Eliodi stands the girl Cartessa. The girl's hair is shorn down to the scalp. Her cheeks dirty from working in the engine room. Her choice, for she claimed correctly to be good with machines. Cartessa says,
Fleet is getting bigger.
Every day.
Eliodi says with no small pride. The nation fleet is now 24 ships strong. That's not figuring in the contingent of old starfighters they've brought on board and retrofitted, which are now flying the colors of their new wild space nation. Red, yellow, and black. The fleet comprises half ships they've stolen, half those brought here out of the chaos of a galaxy gone awry. Pirates and refugees who have nowhere to turn. Who have seen the protections of the Empire turn to vapor, and who fear the coming of the New Republic and its laws sweeping across the systems. Eliodi fears that too.
The new republic is growing. The empire will soon be gone. Even now, Xi is reliably informed that on a world called Jakku, the empire is losing its fight. Maybe its last fight against the republic. What then? What will become of the rest of the galaxy? Eliodi turns from regarding Xi nation outside the Star Destroyer to those within it. Many come seeking asylum, but having no ships. Those who do now serve as crew. Down below were once a series of connected hangar bays. Gray, sterile, with a singular function. That has changed. Now the hangar bays are homes, tents, shipping pods, ramshackle crate shacks. Thousands dwell here. They live. They operate markets. They cook food, using jury-rigged thermal vents carved out of the underfloor ducts. And color is cast far and wide. Motley hues from red tents, spray-tagged containers. The raiment of many cultures and many species and many worlds. Everything is art and chaos and noise. It is just as Eliodi wants it. Your mother around somewhere? Eliodi says to the girl.
No. I ditched her on the engineering sublevel.
Cartessa pouts.
She won't leave me alone.
She is your mother. It is her job not to leave you alone. You should be nicer to her. Poor fool woman followed you here into this glorious madhouse. This wondrous nation of derangement. Do not shut her out. Cartessa sighs.
Fine.
Good.
After a few minutes of scuffing her heels, the girl pipes up.
Can I ask you something?
You may.
How is this all going to work?
This all what now?
This pirate nation. Pirates don't make nations.
These pirates do. I do.
Why? How?
Girl, it's like this. The sea is changing, and the tides are shifting. It's about to get real nasty for us nasty types. Either we're going to be running from the new sheriff in town, or we're going to be trying to kill each other in the farthest flung dung heap systems, stabbing each other over a few scraps of what was once ours by right. I'm proposing we get together, and we stay together. Scoundrels like us, we always worked together. It just wasn't official. So I'm making it official.
Frustration darkens Cartessa's brow.
But that doesn't answer my question. Pirates are selfish. You're in it for yourselves.
That's true enough, she answers. But we can all be in it for our mutual benefit. Some predators are lonely things, big and scary and all by themselves. Others know when they need each other. They know when to form a pack. Used to be I had a pirate crew of a few hundred. Now I got a crew of 10,000. And that number is going up, up, up. We will ransack, pillage, and steal. We will kill less, because it is the threat of our numbers, not the threat of our weapons, that will precede us. We will share the spoils equally, not so that we may be rich, but so that we may be fed, and fat, and happy together, swilling and singing, and whatever other salaciousness comes to the fore of our nasty little minds.
The girl appears to chew on this, like it's a piece of gristle she can't quite get out of her teeth. Seems she's about to say more, but an interruption from her Amwati first mate, Shishu, prevents that.
She's beak clacks together.
We have visitors.
Come to revel in my elegance, Eliodi asks.
The Amwati seems guarded.
We need you on the bridge now.
Eliodi asks the girl.
Want to come?
I do.
Then let's go.
Together they walk the length of the balcony overlooking the hangar deck, presently named Hangar Town, though that is its third name, and other names may yet come. before turning in toward the turbo lifts. They take the lift up to the bridge, riding in silence. Eliodi with Xur chromatophoral cape tucked around Xur like a cocoon. Once on the bridge, Xi sees what just dropped out of hyperspace. 3 Star Destroyers.
Imperial II class,
says Gunner Karklin Ryun, a bug-eyed Sasori with a tiny mouth and sharp teeth. Many Sasori choose to wear mechanical suits to compensate for their diminutive size, but Ryun has always preferred to remain, as he puts it, pure organic. The Sasori says,
they're trying to hail us now.
One of his bulbous eyes winces.
They might think we're actually Imperials. They haven't seen the rest of the fleet yet. Could be a good ruse.
The Amwati concedes. Shishu says,
yes, yes, that could work. We encourage them to think we're a lingering remnant. We offer them safety and succor. Then we press gang them.
We destroy them, Eliodi declares.
What? But those are good ships.
We destroy them, and we send their pieces to the New Republic, along with any escape pods we can catch in our pretty little net.
Noticing the stares coming your way, Eliodi clarifies.
These ships are running. Look at the battle damage. They've taken fire, and recently. And behold those hyperspeed vectors. They're coming from near to the unknown. They're coming from Jakku. We do a little cleanup here for the New Republic. Then we send them the bill.
But the New Republic is no friend of ours,
Cartessa says.
No, and they never will be. But maybe this will convince them to look the other way for a while. Maybe this will give us an air of legitimacy,
Eliodi says with a sweep of the hand, as if she is trying to run her fingers through a rain of stardust.
Set the whole fleet to attack.
They have considerable firepower.
Do it!
The other fleet captains will want to confer.
If they take damage, I will personally repay them. There will be recompense. I am enacting my divine right. Attack!
Shishu nods, hesitantly, then commands the rest of the bridge crew. The demand cascades through them, and a flurry of activity ensues. Targeting computers are spun up, weapons systems brought online. The tractor beam is spun to readiness. Cartessa looks to Eliodi.
Do you know what you're doing?
Eliodi grins like a moon sliver.
No, girl. That's what makes this so interesting. The present is a pair of dice, always about to leave my hand. And I never know if it'll come up 0 or 1, win or lose.
Outside, the void lights up with fire as the attack begins. The Star Destroyers do not have a chance. Soon the New Republic will have a present from His Highness. Her glory, his wonder, her luminous magnificence. The Picaroon, the Plunderer, the pirate ruler of wild space, the glorious knave, Eliodi Maracavagna.
Chapter 35. This is the observatory. It is one of many scattered across the galaxy. All of them are laboratories, in a sense, and all of them look beyond the galaxy's margins in different directions. At the same time, each is also its own unique entity. Palpatine began establishing the observatories before the start of the Galactic Empire, infusing each with purpose. Some were meant to house ancient Sith artifacts, others designed to host powerful weapon designs, or the weapons themselves. Others still meant as prisons, harnessing the life forces of those captured within for a variety of strange purposes. This one, the Jakku Observatory, has its own function. It is part of the contingency. From here, the observatory appears only to be a bunker, mostly buried in the mounding sand. If any would approach, the turrets or the sentinel droids would make swift work of them.
It has long been protected here, mostly hidden, only recently emerging, at his command. As Gallius Rax and the transport ship enter the shadow of the plaintive hand, approaching the observatory, he sends another command. This one to power down the turbo lasers and the sentinel droid defenses. He sends this command through the sentinel that pilots the ship, for all the sentinels are networked together. Beyond the observatory, another shape emerges, because as he powers down the defenses, he also programs the landing dome to rise. And rise it does, bubbling up out of the sand, gently turning as the scree and grit slip free from its rounded surface. The metal dome telescopes open. It reveals a ship, gleaming bright in the dust-filtered sun.
The Imperialis,
Brendel Hux says, leaning forward in the cockpit. Tashu is there with them, and as he sees the ship, he giggles, clapping his hands like a gluttonous child, seeing a tray of cakes come out of the oven. Hux has a voice of reverence and confusion as he says,
I thought the Emperor's ship was destroyed.
It was, Rax answers. Stolen by a gambler, then scuttled. But it was one of many.
As he understands it, all of the observatories play host to a functional replica of the Emperor's pleasure yacht. The observatories serve as receptacles for old Sith artifacts, too. And should those artifacts ever need to be moved off-site, the yachts are there for just such a purpose. Slowly, their transport settles into the well of the valley, easing against the dust-swept stone. The observatory awaits. From here, it is only a broad door in the side of a dune. The rest lies concealed beneath Jakku.
I still don't understand what's happening,
Hux says. This empire is ended. A new one must begin.
The domain is clear. The board swept clean, he thinks.
A new domain must be made. Take your son and the other children. Go to the Imperialis. Prep the ship for takeoff.
How can there be a new empire?
Brendel blusters.
The one we had is gone. We do not number enough to begin anew.
There are others,
Tashu says, sing-songy.
Once we had the calculations, we sent another ship ahead.
Calculations? What calculations? What are you...
Brendel, please. Time is fleeting fast. Too fast. Go to the ship. I will join you there.
And just in case, Rax puts a gently threatening hand on the man's arm.
Understand, you will help be an architect of the future to come. You are a visionary, and that is why you are here, alone.
This is not a time to test me.
This is a time to trust me.
Do you trust me?
The man, red-cheeked and obviously afraid, nods.
I do.
Good. Now go. Go like the skittermouse.
To Tashu, he says,
Are you ready to fulfill our destiny, Advisor Tashu?
Tashu licks his teeth and shudders as if experiencing otherworldly pleasure.
All glory to the contingency. All glory to Palpatine.
Yes, Rax says, mirroring the same sycophantic smile.
All glory.
It takes both of their handprints to open the door. Tashu on one side, Rax on the other. The scan plates shine around their splayed fingers. Behind the door, a mechanism fires up, groaning and grinding. The door, gold as the sun, opens slowly, rolling upward. When they enter, the door closes behind them. Rax walks ahead of Tashu. He moves forward with a confident stride. The pentagonal hallway descends slowly at a gentle angle. It's formed of burnished metal and black glass, with lines of red light framing every angle.
Every 10 steps is a pillar holding up the world, preventing the sands from pressing down and swallowing the observatory whole. Everything is clean and